Please do turn back in that part of scripture that Jane read for us earlier, Daniel chapter 3. It's a remarkable story, isn't it? But I wonder if sometimes when you hear these stories of great faith, that rather than being encouraged and spurred on, you're actually left kind of deflated. I remember a few years ago trying to encourage a friend to read more Christian biographies, and his response was just that. He said that rather than being encouraged when reading these accounts of amazing Christians who were on fire for the Lord, instead he found himself being discouraged because actually he became increasingly aware of his own shortcomings and lukewarm devotion in comparison. And I get where he's coming from. My dear dad, who died just 6 months ago, had started to write an autobiography over recent years. And from the bits of that I have, I see something in his life which makes me question my own devotion to the Lord. So, for example, he writes of the first night he spent in the RAF up north in Cheshire. And there, as a young believer starting life in the armed forces, he resolved to put the Lord first. So on that very first night, in front of 21 other recruits in the dorm, Dad knelt down at the side of his bed and prayed. And in the autobiography, he describes how a hush descended on the room. The noise and chatter and laughter suddenly stopped as all eyes turned to look in bemusement and shock at the strange sight of a man in prayer. And as I read of what my dad did then and on other occasions, I have to ask myself, would I have done the same? Would I have made such a public display of allegiance to the Lord, knowing the inevitable scorn and mocking I'd face as a result? Or would I have instead have done things in a more discreet, more unnoticeable way? Likewise, as I read this story of the stand that these three believers take, I'm made to consider what I would have done if I was in their shoes. Would I have stayed standing, or would I have instead compromised, perhaps justifying in my mind that it would be okay to bow down to this idol because it's not really what our bodies do that count, it's the heart that God looks at, or some other similar fudged argument? Would I have stood for the Lord, or would I have bowed to the pressure? And you know, I'm sure that dilemma is not unique to me. In fact, in the early years of the church, when Christians faced fierce persecution from the Roman authorities, there was even a name given to the many Christians who gave in to the pressures they faced and disowned the Lord. They were known as the lapsi, which means the lapsed. And in the following years that followed, debate raged in the church about how to treat the many lapsi who had, under pressure, caved in, failed to stand, but who now regretted their actions and wanted to be part of the fellowship again. Yet, despite all I've said, I do think this passage, Daniel 3, should leave us encouraged rather than discouraged. I trust this story will do us all much good today, and hope it will enable each of us here to stand firmly for the Lord. I hope it'll help us to really be on fire for him. So how can we make a remarkable stand like these men did? Well, I think what we should learn today is that when you see the world as God sees it, when you see it as it really is, when you see people for what they are, when you see idols for what they are, when you see God for what he is, well, actually, it's not remarkable at all to make a stand for him. Because really, this story in chapter 3 is less to do with the remarkable faith of remarkable people and more to do with the faith that should naturally come from intimately knowing a remarkable God. So let's dig in And we'll divide this chapter into three parts. Firstly, we're going to look at verses 1 to 7 under the heading, The Statues We Face. The Statues We Face. Now, I've just mentioned how important it is for us to see the statues that we face for what they really are. And I think the lesson we should learn here in these first verses about the idols or statues that we face is that appearances can be very different to reality. If we see the statues we face for what they really are, it'll be much easier for us to stand up to them. Now, hold that thought in your mind, but let's tackle first their appearances. And what a description we give in verse 1. After Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2, where he sees that huge statue with the golden head, which gets toppled by a small stone, it might seem somewhat surprising that he then goes about making his own golden image. But it may be that a long time has passed since then, and he's put all of those things and the interpretation of that dream right to the back of his memory. Or it may be that the statue that he made bore little resemblance to the one in his dream. Actually, if you look at the dimensions given of the statue here, it's 10 times as tall as it is wide. It makes you wonder if this was a person at all. Some of the commentators think this was more likely to be an obelisk or a depiction of one of the Mesopotamian gods. Well, whether it was a person or not, whether it looked like that statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream or not, what we can say for certain is that the appearance of this statue would be very impressive. It's covered in gold and it's 90 feet tall. That's what 60 cubits means. It's 90 feet tall. And if you were standing under it, looking up at it like those people were, I'm sure you'd get a sense both of its gravitas and presence, but also probably of your own insignificance, your own smallness in comparison. But you know, it wasn't the statue that the people there that day should be most concerned about. It was the one who was behind the statue that they really had to watch. And it's as if in these opening verses, verses 1 to 7, that the writer wants to remind us of the power of this opponent, the power of the man who commanded this statue into being. So notice the way that Nebuchadnezzar is described in these opening verses. Verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 2, King Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 3, King Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 5, King Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 7, King Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 8, King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, what's interesting is that after this point in the chapter, the title king is largely dropped by the author. So if you were to look at verse 13 or verse 14 or 15 or 16 or 19 or 26 or 28, there he's described not as King Nebuchadnezzar, but simply Nebuchadnezzar. Seems that the writer wants to drive home in these opening verses the role and the power of the man that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stand before. Nebuchadnezzar is king. He's the powerful king. And in verse 4, we see what this powerful king declares. You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, to fall down and worship. The powerful king doesn't request, he commands. And the penalty for disobedience is immediate, and it's devastating, isn't it? Look at verse 6. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. So what happens in verse 7 shouldn't surprise us at all. This gathering was of all the officials of the land. It's probable that there were several hundred people there. And in verse 7, we're told that as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, tire, and lyre, and so on, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped. Think of the huge pressure that would have been put on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to conform. It's very difficult to go against the majority, isn't it? Often our thoughts or actions are carried along by popular opinion, and often popular opinion is wrong, but how hard to stand against it, how hard it must have been for these three men to remain standing when all around them, everyone is bowed to the floor. I wonder if they felt a kind of pull, a tug to do the same, to conform. We can see from these descriptions some of the pressures that these young believers faced that day, can't you? There was the presence of the statue, the power of the king, the penalty for disobedience, the pressure to conform. And yet, despite all of these pressures, they do remain standing. And I think there's clues in these first seven verses as to why that was the case. Because we said at the start, didn't we, that appearances can be very different to reality. And that actually we need to see these statues, these idols, for what they really are. Maybe then we'll find that it's not so compelling to bow down to them after all. And so as I've studied these verses this week, I'm drawn to the conclusion that the writer here had the second psalm in his mind when he wrote this account. There in Psalm 2, we see the kings of the earth fighting against God. It says in Psalm 2, verse 2, the kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bond apart and cast away their cords from us. The kings come together to fight against the Lord. And yet in Psalm 2, verse 3, we see how God responds to this attack from the kings. It says, Psalm 2, verse 3, he who sits in heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. I think we can imagine in verses 1 to 7, the Lord laughing and holding Nebuchadnezzar and his cronies in derision. And I think that comes across particularly in a sarcastic style of writing used here and in the turn of phrase. So let's think again about the statue, which on first appearance seemed so impressive. Look at how the writer describes it here. Verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image. So this isn't a god, is it? It's just something that a man made. And that point is drilled home time and time again in these first verses. Verse 1, he set it up. Verse 2, the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 3, the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 5, the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 7, the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. The appearance may be impressive, but the reality the writer wants us to see is that this is just a man-made, set-up object. It's nothing in comparison to the real God. Of course it's not. Notice, too, the way that the writer describes the ridiculous pomp of the occasion. We've got these long, repeated descriptions in verse 2 and 3 of satraps and prefects and governors and counselors and treasurers and justices and magistrates and officials. Then we've got the long repeated description in verse 7 and verse 4 and 7 and 10 and 15 of horns and pipes and lyres and trigons and harps and bagpipes and every kind of music. And although at first this makes the chapter hard to read, it seems to me that in light of Psalm 2, that the writer has laid it out like this to show us just how ridiculous this all is. Can't you see that he who sits in the heavens laughs and holds them in derision as he sees this ridiculous man-made setup trying to rival him? This really is no match. There is no comparison. Matt said in his first sermon from the series that the main overarching lesson of the book of Daniel is this. In spite of present appearances, God is in control. In spite of present appearances, God is in control. Can you see that behind the way things appear to be, behind our own fiery trials, God is actually absolutely in control? And if we see these statues and enemies and pressures and fiery trials for what they really are, doesn't it help you to see why it's not that remarkable to make a stand for the real Almighty God? And yet, despite knowing all of this, I think we can say that the stand that these three young believers make is at the very least very inspiring. So how do they do it? Well, let's think about that further in our second point from verses 8 to 18. The stand that we take. The stand we take. And actually, it may be more accurate to entitle this point, the stands we take, because really these believers take more than one stand, don't they? There's two separate stands described here. First, they make more of a private, silent stand. They choose not to bow down when the music starts. And I guess this could have gone unnoticed by the king were it not for those jealous accusers who come with their malicious words in verses 8 to 12. And so after this private stand, they're brought before the king in verse 13. And in view of everyone, they're given another chance. And it's at this point they have to make a second stand which is much more decisive, much more public, much more verbal. Similar to what happened to Peter on the night the Lord was betrayed, isn't it? Peter made the initial private stand, which was to follow the Lord from Gethsemane, even though others fled. But then afterwards in the courtyard, Peter finds himself in the spotlight, in full public view, and it's quite a different stand that's demanded of him there. Well, likewise, there's all sorts of stands that we are called to make, isn't there? Sometimes that stand is proactive, sometimes it's reactive. Sometimes the stand we make is public, in full view of everyone. But sometimes the stand we make is more private, maybe not seen or known by anyone but God. So the stand we make could be a proactive stand, like the decision to not cheat in an exam, or to not backdate or manipulate a form at work, or to not watch certain things. But it could be more reactive, perhaps like the decision to hold your tongue when the conversation around you turns to gossip or moaning and you're asked to share your opinion. People might not even notice that you've taken a stand when you make these sorts of choices. They're largely private. But sometimes our stand is much more public, isn't it? It could be a proactive public stance, like speaking out intentionally about the gospel, or like standing up for a truth in the face of injustice or oppression. Or it could be a more reactive public stance, a bit like what we have here, where you're asked one of those awkward questions in front of your friends or colleagues or classmates, and all eyes turn to you. We'll hopefully have the opportunity at the home groups this week to share more of our own experience of the types of stands that we've been made to make. But can you see that arguably the key moment in this chapter really comes here in the public stand of verses 15 to 18 rather than in what follows? In verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar, who we know from previous verses is in a furious rage, poses this challenge. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Now, we know from verse 12 and 14 that Nebuchadnezzar did worship various gods, but in making this challenge, he seems to be claiming that actually no god is more powerful than him. Well, the response that these three men give to Nebuchadnezzar's challenge reveals a lot about the faith they have and the God they serve. And I think if we look at their response, we could all be helped in our own stands. We could all be helped in our day-to-day walk with the Lord. So look with me at verse 16. Now, it may seem that their response here is a bit rude when they say, we have no need to answer you in this matter. But I don't think that's the intention. Actually, I think they're simply answering the first part of Nebuchadnezzar's question in verse 14. There, Nebuchadnezzar asks them if it's true that they refuse to serve his gods, and they, still standing up while everyone around them bows, say in effect, you know it's true, we can't deny it, you can see with your own eyes that we're still standing, there's nothing for us to say about this. But then they move on to the penalty that awaits them. Verse 17, if this be so that you will throw us into a furnace, then we'll answer your second question. You've asked, O king, who is the God who would deliver us out of your hands? And we can tell you that our God, whom we serve, is able to do just that. Notice in what they say here, their absolute confidence in God's power and ability. They know for sure that God is able to deliver them because they know him, don't they? He's not a God. They call him our God. And so we can have the same confidence in any situation that we face. Like them, we can say that our God is able. Our God is able to deliver us. Our God is able to heal us. Our God is able to change our circumstances, to give us the desires of our heart, to bring revival. Our God is able to answer all of our prayers. We know that is true. We know it from creation. We know it from the scriptures. We know it from history. We know it from those Christian biographies that we fail to read. We know it from each other's lives. So let's stir each other up and remind each other that our God is able. If God wasn't able, why would we bother praying to him? These believers know that God is able, but notice that there's more to faith than this. Faith holds firm in one hand that God is able, but holds in the other that God does what he wants, and he does what is best. Faith declares, as we read in verse 18, God is able to deliver, but then says, but if not, we will not compromise, we will not disobey him, we will hold fast. I think perhaps those three words in verse 18, but if not, are the most striking, the most poignant words in this whole chapter. Because often we live in the but if nots, don't we? We know that God can heal, but in the mystery of his purposes, he often chooses not to. We know that God can mercifully save, but in the mystery of his purposes, he often chooses not to. We know that God can miraculously rescue us from the fiery trials that we face, but in the mystery of his purposes, he often chooses not to. In fact, it may be fair to say that normally he chooses not to. And so for every one story we have of a miraculous deliverance by the fourth man of chapter 3, there's probably 1,000 where that same sort of delivery didn't happen, where the saints burned. Read of the heroes of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, and you'll see there that while some of them stopped the mouths of lions and quenched the power of fire, verse 34, must be harking back to this passage, that there were many others, verse 36, who were stoned, sawn in two, killed with the sword. But that is what faith is. Faith declares that God is able, and we do not know what he will do, but whatever he chooses to do, we will serve him. And so Job of old could say in faith, though he slay me, I'll hope in him. And so I said, the key moment in this chapter seems to me not how God chooses to deliver, but instead in the humble faith of those who choose to submit to a remarkable God, no matter what, even if it is a but if not, because they know that this remarkable God that they serve is able. He always does what is right. We're talking about God being remarkable. Let's move on to our final point, where we see more of who God is. In verses 19 to 30, we can learn more about the God we serve. Seems to me that in some ways, these opening chapters of Daniel each focus on a different attribute of God's character. So in chapter 1, we see the God who rules. In chapter 2, we see the God who reveals. And here in chapter 3, we see the God who rescues. That's the aspect of God's character I want us to dwell on just now, the God who rescues. Because remember again the question that Nebuchadnezzar posed in verse 15. He says, who is the God who is able to deliver you out of my hands? And here in verses 19 to 30, we see God answering that question in such a remarkable way that it leaves this man who people described as the King of Kings totally changed and humbled. And actually, the answer to the question of verse 14 has a huge significance, not just for Nebuchadnezzar and the three believers there, but also for all of us here too. So let's think about the way God rescues his people. And I want you to notice in verses 19 to 23 just how real the danger they face is. Nebuchadnezzar, in a fit of rage, orders that the furnace is heated up 7 times hotter than normal. And although that probably couldn't literally happen, it still shows something of the reality of the danger that these men face. The furnace is described in verse 22 as being overheated, and this becomes so dangerous that even the soldiers who guard these believers end up being consumed and destroyed by it. In verse 21, we're shown that these friends are totally bound. And this reminds us, doesn't it, that not only was this danger very real, but these men really have no chance at all of escape. There's nothing they can do in the face of the danger ahead of them. And so in verse 23, we read that they fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. The picture we have here is one of needy, helpless people facing a real danger that they have no ability to save themselves from. I wonder if that reminds you of our own predicament. Well, in the midst of this terrible, dangerous, hopeless situation, we read of something quite wonderful in verses 24 and 25. Nebuchadnezzar counts not 3 men in the fire, but 4. And as he looks at the 4th man, he notes that his appearance is like a son of the gods, or as the King James Version puts it, the Son of God. Nebuchadnezzar witnesses what was probably Jesus himself come down from glory to dwell with his faithful people in their fiery trial. And if that is the case, how apt that the answer to the question, who is the God who will deliver, is shown to be Jesus, whose very name means saviour or rescuer. Jesus is the answer to Nebuchadnezzar's question. Jesus is the God who rescues. But notice here that Jesus does not save them from entering the trial. He doesn't prevent them from falling bound into the fire, but he does walk with them in it. How similar to the trials that we often face. Jesus walks with us in them. Another thing to note here is that as the Son of Man comes down to rescue his people, the deliverance that they receive is described as being total. It's complete. As Nebuchadnezzar and his servants examine the men in verse 23, they can't help but notice that the fire has not had any power over their bodies. They're unbound, unhurt, unsinged, and untouched by the very real and powerful danger of that fire. Nebuchadnezzar had asked, hadn't he, who was the God who would deliver Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from his hands? Well, never in a million years would he have anticipated the Son of God himself coming down into the fire and delivering these men fully from it. And so thus, it's no surprise that this really does have a profound impact on that once proud, once powerful, once impressive king. The man who thought he was the King of Kings and above the gods is left humbled and forever changed. And he ends this chapter blessing God. So see the way he describes the Lord here. He acknowledges in verse 26 that he is the Most High God and declares in verse 28, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar received the answer to his question of verse 15, and so finishes this account by sharing the answer he has learnt with all the officials of his kingdom. Verse 29, there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Nebuchadnezzar now realizes that this God is different, that this God is remarkable, that this God is incomparable, and that this God is worth serving. And as he sees the Son of God, Jesus, for himself, he discovers that this is the God who rescues, the God who saves. I wonder if you've experienced Jesus in that way, because as we read here of the very real danger of fire and of the way Jesus came to deliver the helpless people from it and of the way his people are left totally unscathed by it. I'm certain that Jesus wants us to see these things and remember and see them as a pointer to the rescue that he offers to each of us here through his very real death on the cross. The very real danger that we all face is not fire as such, but hell. And I don't think it's an accident that Jesus describes hell in Matthew chapter 13 in exactly the terms we read of in this chapter, as a fiery furnace. Let's look at Matthew chapter 13, verse 41. Jesus says there, Matthew chapter 13, verse 41, "The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Jesus said that hell is like a fiery furnace. And yet the next verse in Matthew chapter 13 says this, "The righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father." Jesus shows the very real danger of hell, but also offers up the possibility of salvation from it. And so Jesus did come down. Again, we know that, don't we? Long after the situation we read about in Daniel chapter 3, Jesus did come down. Again, he came down to rescue. He walked with us, and he suffered the fiery furnace of the cross for us, so that whoever trusts in him can be left unbound, unhurt, unsinged, untouched by the punishment that should rightly be ours. If you're a Christian here this morning, you too have experienced a remarkable rescue by a remarkable God. And this not because of your own remarkable faith or stand, but instead because of the wonderful mercy of God. How the truth of God's mercy to us should leave us like the characters we read of here, should leave us like Nebuchadnezzar, humbled, blessing God. Should leave us like these three men who in verse 28 are described as those who trust God and those who yield themselves to him. Well, as we draw things to a close, let's return to our starting place. How can we not be discouraged or deflated when we read of the remarkable faith that other believers have displayed? Well, I think first we need to realize something about the obstacles, the enemies that we face. These things really are nothing compared to the God in heaven who laughs and holds them in derision. But then I think we do need to look up. I think we need to remember the God who really is in control, the God who comes down and walks with us in our trials, the God whose very name is Saviour. Truly, he giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labourers increase. To added affliction, he addeth his mercy. To multiply trials, he multiplies peace. So may God's grace and his mercy and his strength and his peace be experienced by all of us here in the days ahead. Amen. We're going to sing together a song which in some ways is very similar to the things that we've been looking at here. I do not know what lies ahead. In that song, you see the writer saying, "I don't know what the days ahead hold, but what I do know is who God is and what a difference that makes." So let's sing this song together.